And now a story about racism and reconciliation between two brothers in a white family. Barry Mosier is a professor of art at Smith College. He's also a celebrated and award-winning illustrator of more than 350 books, including critically acclaimed versions of Moby Dick and the King James Bible. Mosier has lived in Western Massachusetts for half a century. His true roots, however, are in the South. Mosier grew up in Tennessee, in a time and in a family where racism was as elemental to life as the soil itself. For example, his uncle was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Mosier recently published a memoir titled We Were Brothers, and in it, he writes about how that hate destroyed his relationship with his older brother, Tommy. Mosier read part of the book to us, a moment in the 1940s where he and his brother were riding the bus home and young Barry decided to sit in the back with their African-American neighbors.
Well, I was afraid of my brother Tommy when he got mad, and I could just as easily get off at the next stop since it was only a short block farther up the road, right in front of our Aunt Velma's house. I could have avoided my brother altogether had I done that. For all I knew, Mother might have been visiting, as she often did, sitting out on the big screened-in front porch sipping iced tea and shelling peas or stringing beans. When the bus stopped, Tommy got off at the front. I got off at the back. The doors were sliding shut when he hit me, a right to my head. He hit me again as I was falling to the hot pavement. I sprawled into gravel and dusty grass, bleeding from nose and mouth. And then he kicked me. I curled up in a ball, and he kicked me again, and again. And through the ringing of my ears, I heard him say, "Don't you never sit with again. You hear me, you little morphodite? You hear me? Do you hear me?" I lay whimpering and did not answer him. Then thud, another kick. When he turned and walked away, I saw, through squinted eyes and tears, that his fists were still balled up. I sat up, tasting the iron of my blood mingling with the salt of my tears and the smells of hot summer tar and the diesel exhaust of the bus pulling away. I heard Tommy whistle for our dog, like nothing had happened.
Barry Mosier reading from his memoir, We Were Brothers. Though Mosier eventually fled north to Massachusetts, he describes Tommy's racism like a scar, an angry wound in both their brains and their souls that took decades to heal.
He rubbed my nose in this racism stuff all of my life, and he knew that I didn't see eye to eye with him nor my family. Not even, since a six-year-old kid, My mother picked me up one time in a department store because I had run to a water fountain that wasn't for whites only. And when my mother picked me up and I was demanding of her, "Why can't I drink out of that? There's a big line here. There's no line over there." My mother says, "Well, honey, that's because drink out of that." And when your mother tells you something like that and you're 6 years old, you don't question it. That's the word of God. Mm-hmm. So I believed that, but it didn't make sense. And he knew that it didn't make any sense, but he continued to rub my nose in it, and I think he did it for pure pleasure.
Obviously, this is a book about you and your brother.
Yes.
It's you and your brother and the place and the time that you grew up in.
Absolutely.
Because I have to say, like, I was... It's like jaw-dropping to read about how deep and pernicious and normal, if I can put it that way, the racism was. I mean, you write examples of how... tell me, I mean, because I don't want to tell the whole story. Like, tell me about how, you know, your mother and your family looked upon the African-Americans who lived, you know, right across the street from you.
Yeah, my mother's best friend growing up was a black woman by the name of Vanita Golston. And Vanita came through the front door. She sat at the same table with my mama and drank coffee or whatever. But if there were company there, if there was a car in the driveway, let's say, or, you know, she suspected that that might be a Christian Science practitioner visiding with my mother, she'd go to the back door. Huh. And my mother was no longer Billy, which is short for Willamana, as Vanita always called her. But now, if there were company in the house, she went to the back door, and it was Miss Willamana.
You know, and there's a like a little paragraph early in the book where you describe how when your mother and Vanita were little girls growing up, and there was a day where your mother went to the movies with somebody, and Vanita wanted to go, but she couldn't, and she does something which just broke my heart.
Oh, it breaks my heart too, and I don't even know if I can tell the story without choking up about it. But Vanita wants to go to the movies with my mom, and she was told, "No, you can't go." In fact, the words were, "You even know better than to ask." And so Vanita, this was in a grocery store, my grandfather's grocery store. And in the back of the grocery store, there was a big room where he kept his staples, crackers and flour and so forth. And Vanita went back to that stock room, and she took the barrel top off, got on top of a chair, and dunked her head down in that flour, came back out into the front of the store and says, "Now can I go? Now can I go?" And Vanita told me this story when I was older. And she told it not with any kind of rancor or any kind of anger or hatred, but she just told it as a story.
As a fact of life.
As a fact of life.
So you're the one in your family, you're the one who left the South.
Yeah.
First of all, when did that happen?
1967.
So obviously a very important time in U.S. history. What finally prompted you to make that break, that change?
Racism permeated every part of the society that I was in, that I lived in, and I just simply couldn't take it anymore. I had to get out of there. And I just happened to have been offered a job at a private school in Western Mass. And I took it, and when I moved up here, first time I'd ever seen New England, it was in March, which is not the time to see New England for the first time. And I thought and said to my wife, I said, "I hope to God we don't end up here. I mean, this is a dreadful place." And well, that was 50-something years ago.
Well, I mean, there's a point in the book where you write that I don't think I'm all that different today from who I was then. And as you said, the primary reason I expatriated myself from the South in 1967 was to escape the racism.
Right.
But then, of course, this is 1967, so you also say, "I didn't have the personal, physical, or moral courage to go down to Alabama or Mississippi to help register voters." So the only thing you could do is you left.
I left. That's all I could do. Yeah. I wish I had been stronger. I wish that I had the gumption and the physical courage to confront people who were my family. I mean, confront the Klan. Though I never confronted my uncle. If I'd confronted my uncle, he'd probably kill me. He rode shotgun on a chain gang, you know. So I mean, this stuff is just, it's all through my life. And one of the compelling reasons I wanted to write this story or these stories, I guess it's in a way it's a matter of purging some of this, because you know, I refer to myself as a recovering racist, or as a racist in recovery, because I'm not sure that you can ever purge yourself of all of those things that are put into you when you're between childbirth and 6 years. I certainly do not act in any way, but it's just these things that are there, and it's pernicious. It's the only word for it. It just never goes away. I have a student in my class, a black student. I mean, that word is there. It's the scar that has been put on me from my childhood.
Let me see if I'm hearing you right. You have a black, you're teaching, there's a, in your class, one of your classes right now, there's a black student? And when you say that word's there, man, like it's in your head?
It's in my head. Yeah. I don't utter it out loud unless I get into a conversation. This is one of the things about race in this country, is that black people talk to black people about race, and white people talk to white people about race. Black people don't talk to white people about race, and white people don't talk to black people about race. So if I'm ever given an opportunity to engage that conversation, I will engage that conversation. And every time I have done it, there has never been the slightest bit of anger, of being uncomfortable, because it's an honest conversation, using honest language, even though the language is awful.
This gets to the question that's really at the heart of your memoir. And in fact, it's a question that you wrote to your brother in one of the letters that you exchanged with him, you know, much, much later. Because, and this is from a 1997 letter, you wrote to him, "Why, Tommy, were we so different? We drank the same water, breathed the same air, listened to the same chickens cluck and crow in the morning, everything the same. But you still wonder, like, why were you and he so different? How were you different?"
In any way that you could possibly imagine. He grew up to be politically conservative. I grew up to be politically liberal. He was tall. I'm short. I mean, in any way that you can think, we were opposites of each other.
You know, this is such an American story, right? I mean, it, you know, as I was reading it, I was thinking, this is one of the stories of 20th century America. So, you know, two brothers, South and North, fundamental differences from the start, and a kind of reconciliation, right?
Absolutely.
He stayed in the place that, you know, where the racism was as much a fact of life as the soil of the earth. So, I mean, how did he change over time as the South and was changing?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because I would, if you had asked me that question 10 years ago while he was still alive, I would have said he hadn't. One friend of his, a girlfriend actually, told me that that Tommy had actually legally adopted, but had taken a young black kid under his wing and became his champion, became a surrogate parent to this kid. Now, my family has sported a lot of liars, and my brother being among them, the best of them. And when I mentioned it to one of my nephews, he screwed up his face and said, "That doesn't sound like Daddy." So I don't know, and that's one of the problems with the, as we were saying about the family is a universal drama. I don't know whether he's lying to me or not.
Do you want it to be true?
I do want it to be true. I definitely want it to be true. Yeah, because if it is true, it brings another kind of light to my brother.
But I'm wondering, for you know, for people who have never met you and never met Tommy, when they read this book, what do you want them to come away with?
Well, just what we're talking about, that no matter how deep the divides are within a family, they can always be bridged if the people involved are willing to bridge them. If you're willing to say, "I'm wrong." And I hope it, if anyone comes to this little book, it offers some degree of redemption or the possibility of redemption.
Well, Barry Moser is a professor in residence and printer at Smith College. He is known for his spectacular illustrations of Alice in Wonderland, Moby Dick, and the King James Bible. His most recent book is a memoir called We Were Brothers. Barry Moser, thank you so much for coming in
and sharing your
life with us.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.